First off, just for the transcriptionist, could you state your name?
Jane Place.
Okie doke. And thanks for talking with us. I wanted to begin by asking you a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved in Centennial Campus.
Well, I moved to the Triangle from Berkeley in 1985. Okay. And I had a small child at the time, very small. And so I became a consultant writing federal grant proposals for the university and for other nonprofits, but primarily for the university. When I got here, my husband was hired in as a professor in the School of Design, okay. And so I started writing grants as a consultant. After about 9 years of that, I kind of burned out doing that, and Claude McKinney asked me what I thought I wanted to do, and I said, "Well, I think I want your job." And he said, "Well, what part of my job do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to be involved in the part where you're writing proposals to corporate partners to try to get them to move to Centennial Campus." Well, that was the part of the job he didn't want to do. So they hired me at that point to as an employee of the university to come in and do that. And anyway, that's how I got here. I have a management background, but I'm a writer as well, so it works out well on the marketing side.
And what was your actual job title back then? And what were
you? When I came, it was called Partnership Development Specialist. And at that time, the word marketing was a really foreign word for the university, so they didn't want to have, you know, a marketing vice president or director or anything like that. They wanted, and in fact, partnership development was our major marketing tool. And so partnership development specialist was a title that we just made up, and that's what I was.
and what were, for example, what were some of your duties in that capacity?
Well, you have to remember, at that time, 1994, the office the Centennial Campus Development Office didn't even exist on Centennial Campus. Right. It was in Holiday Hall. So they were just beginning to move over here, and Partners Research Building 3 just opened, mm-hmm. and space was designed in there. So I moved in when the office moved to Centennial Campus. So at that time, we had no marketing or advertising materials. We had no logo. Mm-hmm. We had no rental rates. We had no floor plans. We had none of the sort of materials that any private developer would have. And so that all had to be done. In the meantime, we were also dealing with a pretty steady stream of people from companies, some entrepreneurs, who wanted to move onto the campus. And at that point, all the buildings we had built were really university buildings.
Right.
And so there was a lot of, we were making it up as we went along,
right.
I guess you would say. There are some buildings where we cannot rent out space. There are some buildings where they're just not designed right for corporate partners.
Right.
There was also no signage on the buildings at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really not set up for a corporate partner who wants a prestigious sort of front, road front position. We began immediately accumulating a list of tenants who wanted less than a floor of a building, and many of them only like 1,000 or 2,000 square feet. When Centennial Campus first started, it was thought that it would develop along the Research Triangle Park model, where you'd get an ABB or an IBM, and they'd each have their own building sort of up and down the row of the street. What happened was we attracted a lot of either parts of those companies or smaller companies that wanted to grow. And we were not set up at that time with buildings that were ready for, you know, partial floor tenants. And so we began, with the help of George Worsley, who decided that he would help us put up speculative buildings. And I think he's probably explained to you how they used the grant overhead as collateral to get financing.
Maybe the interviews we have are kind of short and cursory.
Okay.
And if you wouldn't mind, I would love it if you would elaborate on that.
Well, one of the biggest problems facing university research parks is that you have to have something to secure a loan to build a building.
Right.
So if you go out for financing and you're a university, you can't use taxpayer money for a down payment for an industry building. So what George Worsley and Charles Moreland, who was the George Worsley was Vice Chancellor for Finance, Charles Moreland Vice Chancellor for Research at that time, what they decided is that they would go out on a limb and say, we will use the overhead stream from federal grants, so it's not state money, as collateral. Doesn't mean we use it to pay for the buildings, but we use it to secure the loan. And that allowed us to put up speculative buildings, because you just can't group up 10 or 20 small tenants and get them to all sign leases way in advance, you know, 2 or 3 years in advance of the building opening.
Right.
You've got to get the building, at least the steel going up, before they believe you. And at that time, we were not good at getting buildings up in under 3 years, 3 or 4 years. So, you know, we were constantly churning all these people that wanted to come, but we could never get a building up. So that really changed everything. So in 1996, we broke ground, at least, on Research 4, and Partners Building 1, and those were the first two multi-tenant buildings. And boy, we just jammed them full right away. They just filled up right away. At that time, it was a boom time in economic development in the Triangle. The dot-com revolution was going on. There were a lot of companies getting venture capital left and right. It was a very speculative time. And so we really didn't have to go out and advertise to get clients or go out and visit people, you know, across the country. We went in the office every day and did 3 or 4 client presentations that we didn't even solicit.
So this is something I'm interested in, because you don't actually have to go and try to attract partners.
At that time, we did not. Okay. It's different today. But at that time, during the dot-com boom, we did not. And there were also a lot of, there was a lot of backed up demand, remember, because we hadn't had buildings going on.
Right.
People had been hearing about Centennial Campus for almost 10 years, but and they wanted to come, but they didn't know how to get here. So so we as soon as those buildings were ready, boy, we had a lot of latent demand, and we filled them up. And that was great. That enabled us then to say, okay, we're going to do the next building, which is Partners Building 2. And that was our first laboratory building that was multi-tenant. And one of the problems we had with these other buildings was that there was no wet lab space, and there were a lot of biotech companies also starting up at that time. So we built Partners 2, and it had smaller lab spaces, and it also had a laboratory incubator space on the top floor. And that filled up pretty quickly. And in, as that was filling up, that allowed us then to recruit a private developer, Craig Davis, who could see what the demand was, who would come in and speculatively build buildings that were office buildings, and that's Venture 1, 2, and 3, and 4, and Venture Place are all by that developer, and I think he's going to build some more. So he's getting his own financing, and he's managing all the tenants moving in and moving out and all that, but he's working with the university to make sure that every tenant has a partnership relationship with the university. So the growth of Centennial Campus that really took off in the late 90s was really a result of our putting up speculative building, multi-tenant buildings. And that changed the way everybody thought about the campus.
And so these are called venture because of the way they were capitalized? Or?
Well, it's because he thought that would be a good word. One of the sort of rules of thumb in the research park business, the university research park business, is don't number your buildings in the order that you build them, because you don't really build them in order down the road.
Right.
And you can see when you drive in here, you come to Research 4 first, and then there's Research 1, and then there's 3, and then there's 2. And they also say don't put Roman numerals on them, whatever you do, because people can only read Roman numerals up to about 3. So, and, you know, especially if they're, you know, when you're driving fast down the street and so forth. So we immediately started numbering our buildings, and we got to 4 and realized, okay, we gotta get a new number series because we're getting too high. And so then we started the Partners series. Then this is the Venture series.
Right.
And I think ultimately what really has to happen is that all these buildings would be named for somebody, and either donors or whatever. So it's in fact, we had a corporate series. I think ABB's building is now called Corporate One. Right. So, anyway, ultimately, they need to fix that problem.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Well, this is something I hadn't heard actually before. What's the thinking behind not numbering your buildings in sequence?
Well, you know, we don't start at the entrance and then build them
right.
down the street, right?
Right.
So we know why Research 4 comes before Research 1.
Right.
That's because we built Research 4 fourth.
Right.
But to a visitor,
right.
it's completely confusing. To the fire department, if there's a fire, they come in, there's Research 4, okay, 3 must be right next to it.
Right.
No, it's the same. So that everybody says don't do that. And but we were saving it as naming opportunities, and why they haven't sold those naming opportunities is a question for somebody in development, not me.
But the idea is that eventually maybe these Research 1 through 4 will be named something different?
That's right. And I think, EGRC, what used to be known as the Engineering Graduate Research Center, has now
right.
been named for former Chancellor Monteith.
Right.
So they could be honorary naming opportunities as opposed to things used for fundraising.
Right.
But if the College of Textiles, for example, brought in a huge multi-million dollar donor, they might rename the whole College of Textiles,
right.
for example. So, or any of these other buildings. Less likely on these privately owned buildings. Now, these privately owned buildings are built on university land, so they're on leased land, okay? But they still own them.
And what were the dates, roughly, that you worked in this capacity?
I started in January 94, okay. and I left in December 2000. And by that time, the dot-com bust was upon us. I mean, it didn't last very long, in about 5 years. And since I left, and no connection, but since I left, it's a much different kind of environment in the office. You can't just go in and wait for the train to run over you every day now. You have to go out and look for people, and you really have to use relationships with the rest of the economic development community, much more interaction with faculty. It's a harder job
right.
to do now. At that time, you know, we had four people in the office making, say, four presentations each a day. It was crazy trying to keep up with the demand. Now, the big thing that changed right at the point when the office opened up on the campus was that, to that point, although we had said that everybody who would be here would have some connection with the faculty, we really only had ABB.
Right.
And that was an obvious thing, and they did make connections with engineering and math and physical sciences. But there were physical and math sciences. But the world isn't always so obvious. You know, a little software company, pretty obvious. Let's get some computer
right.
science people in here and do it. But we started to realize that these clients who came in were really not organized the way we were.
Right.
You know, they weren't in a single field. They were in a multidisciplinary area. So, for example, if you get a company coming in that makes minimally invasive surgical instruments, you know what I'm talking about, laparoscopes and endoscopes and
so.
Things like that. They don't have to crack your chest.
Right.
They can, you know. Okay, well, the kind of expertise that they need is not just in mechanical engineering, but it's in maybe composite materials. There's usually a video. You know, they're watching
right.
a video source while they're doing it. There's optics for the lenses.
Hmm.
They have to test those instruments on animals. There's you know, all kinds of electronics involved, and then there's the whole biomedical engineering aspects of it. So it's very multidisciplinary. So the partnership development model that we pioneered and developed in the mid 90s was that, okay, let me learn. I, as the partnership development specialist, need to learn as much as I can about your company and what you do before you come to visit. And then I'll line up not just the dean or the research vice chancellor to talk to you, but our top people in the fields where you are looking for research solutions for a round table. And they'll each give you a little presentation just for you, just along your interests. And they would often bring in then their chief scientific officer and some of their developers and engineers. And it just was so successful. I mean, it just knocked their socks off. I mean, can you imagine if you went to a big university in a town you've never been to before, and they lined up all their best people around the table just for you, for hours? So, you know, and then we gave them tours and presentations and all kinds of things. But, and then our proposals became much more than here, sign this intent to lease.
Right.
It was a binder of materials describing those programs and what those people were doing and talking about it, what we can do together, what amenities they might share on Centennial Campus. You know, I would say that we became much more professional about marketing right during that time because Claude McKinney had a staff for the first time, a couple of people on staff. So that partnership development model, to my knowledge, is still in place today. Usually it would take us about 3 times as long to prepare for the meeting as it would to actually have the meeting. And when we did it right, it really, really worked. So,
Terrific. Could you talk for a second about maybe the difference between some of the differences between private and government partnerships? Are there any special considerations for a government project that might not apply?
It's a little bit more the other way. The biggest part of the negotiation when you're doing industry research, whether they're located here or elsewhere, is the intellectual property rights. You know, who owns what's going to be invented. If I hire your graduate students to work in my, you know, for-profit company,
right,
and they discover something while they're in there, are they going to go publish it before I can patent it? Who owns that patent? And, you know, can I make them wait for a year? Well, you know, we can't.
Right.
They have to be able to publish. So you have to decide, you know, what people are going to be doing and where, you know, what the rights will be, you know, whether you're going to keep those people away from areas where they'll be actually doing that and keep them more on the development side. So that's always the biggest thing. With the government, you know, if they fund you, they you know, you get the intellectual property rights.
Right.
And NC State, during that time, the Office of Technology Transfer became known all around the world as one of the best in terms of having the right instruments and the right attitudes about negotiating with private industry. I mean, it's still, you know, you get Mylars and your Lars in a room, it's still not a simple discussion, but... the idea was let's keep it simple. You know, if you invent it, it's yours. If I invent it, it's mine. If we invent it together, we both own it. I mean, that's in simple.
Right.
So that was really important to licensing the rights to inventions that the university owned, than to sometimes our employees or our students or faculty would spin off companies and then locate here.
Right.
So all of that was really hand in hand. So we had a sort of a homegrown strategy for generating companies, small companies, incubator type companies that would locate here. And then they also added a venture capital fund for Centennial Campus projects at that time. So all of that came together and we were really out in front, especially with that venture capital fund. So, you know, this was a big tourist attraction. It still is, but it's... At that time, people were coming from all over the world. How were you able to do this? Because the world is full of research parks that have an incredible entrance sign, beautiful lawns and streets and no buildings.
Right.
Or maybe one building. And it's because they haven't cracked that nut of how to get speculative buildings up.
Right.
And so with that in our whole entrepreneurial strategy here, it all really came together during a time. It was a great time to be at Centennial Campus.
Excellent. And what were some of the characteristics you feel that are required of companies to make them a good fit with Centennial Campus?
Well, there were lots of ways that companies can partner. You know, the simplest is they and at that time, remember, the dot-com companies were all after our young engineers. And you may remember in the news, they were hiring some kids in the 6th and 7th grade that were just incredible computer scientists already, remember? So they didn't care if they were even graduated yet, but they wanted to get them before they graduated because there was so much competition out in Research Triangle Park. They wanted to get as close to the campus as possible, hire them before they graduated, test them out, and then keep them on the payroll because it was very tough to get young graduating engineers at that time. So... that was, you know, that's probably the simplest way of partnering. And in a way, you know, with that, it's really an agreement between the company and the student. And we don't make any money on it. Others would hire, they would sponsor senior design projects maybe, or they would actually contract for a research project, which would mean a faculty member, maybe a couple students. Others would join our research centers, which have fees anywhere from $5,000 to $150,000 a year. Some would sponsor big research projects. Many of them had employees that wanted to become adjunct faculty, and therefore right. they were then helping teach courses and advising graduate students. We shared brown bag lunch kind of presentations about what each other was doing. A lot of training partnerships. So they could send their employees to our computer training unit at McKimmon Center and get trained. They could take advantage of conference rooms all over campus and share in things that we were already doing. So if we were having a speaker for a particular department they were interested in, they could do that. So it's not, the partnership isn't that the company writes us a big check. That's the sort of development model, the fundraising model. And we're certainly happy.
Right.
And some of them have written us big checks. They've sponsored, chaired professorships and so forth. The partnership is that the company keeps you grounded in the real world, mm-hmm. saying these are the problems that we're facing. Say an automobile company has problems with fuel efficiency today.
Right.
Well, the weight of the car is a big factor in right. fuel efficiency. Well, guess what? The College of Textiles, in textiles, make up 90 different components in a car. Hmm. And so to the extent that they can, in composites, now we're talking about non-woven and composites, things, everything from the okay, under, you want to stop it?
Yeah, I can stop it.
Yeah, I should.
Oh, wait, here we are. We're recording now.
So. Okay. Well, the real partnership happens when a company keeps us in the real world by telling us, here are the problems in my field. You know, you guys have all the researchers and scientists. Help me figure out a different way to look at this. So I was saying that in cars, one way to get the weight down is to make the components
right.
lighter. So textiles, there are 90 different textile components in an automobile. So they've just had a big conference over in the College of Textiles to talk about automotive, and had the companies come in and then the researchers come in and say, you know, what are the problems and what are new ways that we can look at that? So if certain parts of the engine that are normally made of steel can be made out of carbon fibers, which are, you know, something like 10 times the strength per weight, then, you know, is that an idea? Well, what's the cost efficiency of that and so forth? Those kind of conversations are where that's the ideal kind of partnership.
Right.
And then that will lead often to, okay, well, of all the things I heard today, I'm most interested in that guy. And I think I'm going to try to work out something with him, and then more discussions will happen, and then perhaps a research contract. Mm-hmm. But even if it's not a research contract, think what that professor learned in the discussion
right.
to help in his teaching. So he can give his students much more of a real-world perspective. Or he may direct his students to those companies for summer internships or something like that. So it's all a part of our whole industry partnership thing, which has been going on since the land-grant university was founded, but this is much more intimate. This is, you know, where we should see them every day kind of thing.
So you're talking there about some of the obvious advantages that accrue to the university as a result of having these partnerships. Were there any other advantages that you care to talk about?
The advantages for the university, I mean, the whole reason
right.
is to, you know, for us to better serve our constituents. It's part of our land-grant mission, right? So mm-hmm. the closer we are to them, the more we know about them, the more ideas we're going to have. That means the more good ideas we're going to have. And that's it. That's where, you know, that's what the whole thing is based around. Now, we don't want to lose money while we're doing it, but we didn't have a profit motive going into it either.
Right.
And I feel certain that we're not making a profit on it, because everything that we are not spending on building the buildings, you know, whatever we take in rent beyond that, we are building new roads and new infrastructure. So it'll be a long time before the buildings have paid for themselves and are become university property, and by that time, you know, they'll be as old as the buildings on the main
sure.
campus, and we'll be rehabbing those. So it's not a profit motive. The partnership motive is where it's at. And that is not true for all university research
right.
parks in the country. Many see the research park as a way for the university to make money,
okay.
and they're very disappointed, most of them.
So, you're talking a little bit about how Centennial Campus is maybe distinct from other university research parks. I wonder if you could unpack that idea a little bit.
Well, most university research parks, and I think there are something like 250 in the United States now, and they range from a single building to the Research Triangle Park, which is considered a university research park, even though it's not really, didn't belong to a university, but it was built there because the three universities were here. So they're all over the map in size. At the time, the last time I checked, we were about 16th largest with, at that time, 1,000 acres, and now we have 1,400 or 1,600 acres, I forget what. So, but there are some really large ones. There's one in Huntsville that's, I think, almost as large as it's maybe 4,000 acres, and Research Triangle Park is 7,000 acres. So they range in size all over the place. Most of them are on land that either was bequeathed to the university, it's somebody's farm, or it's some land that the university had, typically not adjacent to the main campus. Sometimes they are in old Army bases that have been decommissioned. Sometimes they're in blighted areas of downtown that the city wants to rehab, and so they'll rehab buildings into, and so it'll start with an incubator and then maybe grow from there. Sometimes universities share the park, like in Philadelphia, they have a park downtown that's one of the better ones, one of the older ones. I think there's something like 8 universities affiliated with it. In our case, we've got 1,000, or at that time, we had 1,000 acres adjacent to the main campus, right on the freeway, 15 minutes from the airport. And that is heaven on earth for research. Very few of them have that. We were also in a boom town. Where all the traffic was heading west in the morning and east in the afternoon, and we were at the opposite end. And so, you know, we have a huge advantage. Now, we say that we don't compete with Research Triangle Park, that we complement them, that very often what people are looking for isn't to own land and buildings, but to rent until they grow. Very often they want to be closer to the university. Sometimes they want, you know, fences and dogs patrolling the property lines if they're a big medical company, for example. So, you know, we complement is what we say. Sometimes we actually competed face-on for things. But in general, it becomes clear pretty quick what people want. To have Research Triangle Park there, which everybody in the world knows about, as, you know, the greatest, biggest, research park in the world, you would think, well, why would we build some little park competing right next to them? It's not really that way. It's that our faculty tell us, well, look, if you're in Research Triangle Park and you're working with the company and you want to talk to us, you can come and see us anytime. But I'm not giving up my parking space in the middle of the day for, you know, very often. So if you're on Centennial Campus, I'll come and see you. And that's it's the intimacy level of the partnership, I guess you would say. So it's always a parking issue with universities. And so if research parks are not adjacent and the faculty have to get in their car to go to the research park, they're not going very often.
That's a terrific point that I don't think I've ever heard. I don't think I've seen.
Now, we haven't totally solved that problem here. We have a Wolfline bus, and at the one time we were talking about a monorail. Some people ride their bikes. We're not that close. In fact, the main campus is so big that you almost don't want to walk from one end to the other. But the idea is, the other way in which Centennial Campus is very different is that the decision was made early on that the university would have students and faculty and classes and offices and labs right on the research campus. Often the research campus is just where the industry people are. And you know, you may have a lot of privileges on the main campus. Maybe they let them use the gym and the library and so forth. But they're really, it's just like being in any other office park. Here we're right next door. And because the campus is so big, we have built it in neighborhoods so that you're not more than 5 minutes walk from the people you most likely would want to talk to. So, you know, the advanced materials neighborhood has things like textiles and civil engineering and electronics and all the, you know, the materials research centers down at the other end of the bridge. This venture buildings tend to be a lot of IT people, right. Although we have, you know, anybody who needs an office is in here. Up the street, we're partners in toxicology, and there's genomics and nanotechnology. Well, now the engineering college is moving here, and they've built those enormous buildings up on the hill, and they're kind of in the middle of everything because it turns out they have something to do with just about everybody.
Sure.
You know, down where the middle school is, the Friday Institute for Education Innovation is right next to the middle school. And so this proximity thing has been guiding everything that we do. And the other thing about these buildings, you don't...
But just to, you were talking about, you know, the point of proximity.
Right. So that, you remember, you notice that the front doors face shared courtyards.
Right.
And the sidewalks go between buildings, not just along the street. So you see people, sometimes a company will have people in both buildings, but you see people crossing over. Also, you have university units in the same buildings and often on the same floor as companies. So USDA... is here. They were in Partners One when they first came, and our Center for Integrated Pest Management, their chief partner, was right there in the same building. I don't know of any other place in the country that has that, but I'm not up to date on these things because I'm out of that field now.
Right.
But that's very unusual, and a lot of people came here to learn about that. Another difference on this campus is that we have, as you anybody can see, a palette of materials for the buildings here. So it's, you know, it's brick, it's precast concrete, it's glass, and it's that raised seam aluminum that you see all over campus. And that I think that the architects have been pretty creative in using those materials and not making every building look alike. But still, it looks like a campus as opposed to a research park where everybody has a, you know, an award-winning building. Mm-hmm. And there's no sort of unity. Now, there's some people that think that's boring, and there are others that think that's pretty cool. Claude McKinney was, you know, he was a designer. He was determined that the campus also look good from the air.
Right.
Because, you know, if you look at Research Triangle Park, you see, and you look down on the IBM plant, all you see is a bunch of air conditioning boxes and, you know, junk all littered all over the roofs. And if you fly over Centennial Campus, not only, you know, do you see that those things are screened off on the roof so that the pedestrians certainly can't see them, but they're organized. But also you can see the pathways and the courtyards and the things that connect the campus. Right up through the center of the oval, it points right at the bell tower on the main campus, for example. And you can see those, if you look outside of this building, Venture One, you see that some of the pillars are on an angle.
Mm-hmm.
They're on that same angle, pointing right to the bell tower. And that's all this stuff is only visible from the air, but someday that'll make a big difference here.
Yeah. Now, thinking back over your career with Centennial Campus, what do you regard as some of your major accomplishments?
Well, I think the partnership development model was something that, I certainly would never have been able to do that alone, but that was something that I worked a lot on and was really proud of. It was the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
In those early days, everything had to be done. You know, the banners that you see on the light poles today, that logo had to be developed and the banners had to be put up. You know, all of the marketing materials and the videos and the hiring and the, you know, once you get a lot of company tenants in here, somebody needs to take care of them. They can't deal with physical plant. You know, they've got to have a property manager. University wasn't geared up for that in those days.
Right.
There were things that I didn't accomplish, but boy, I learned so much just by being on master planning and building design committees. And to the extent that the needs of the company, you know, I had to represent the needs of what I thought the companies were that would go in there. And they didn't have to influence the design of the building. Well, that's easy when you know that the chemical engineering department's going to go on that floor. But if you're building a spec building, then that's a little different. So we had a lot to learn from the private sector about how to put up buildings economically and what the financial model, the tax model needed to be. And So I was not in charge of any of those aspects, but I learned so much about it from everybody else. So we were all just kids making this stuff up, except for Claude, you know, who was the grandfather of the whole place. And we believed, I mean, we used to go to Disney World and Epcot Center to look at that, thinking that somehow that's the way it was going to be. And that was a little far-fetched, but we were all very optimistic about what we could do here, how it could be a beautiful, you know, ecologically benign, easy traffic and parking kind of place, you know, very interactive. The it's interesting, many parts of that are in place, and I think a lot of people would agree that now that the trees are growing up, and to the extent you can get away from the mud and everything from new construction, it's a pretty attractive campus compared to the main campus. What we have, the problem we have not licked here, is food.
Right.
And if you don't have food, people have no reason to leave their building just to hang around. I mean, unless they're going to a meeting. So when you drive down Centennial Campus streets, you don't see a lot of people on the street.
Right.
There's no place to walk to. So as soon as we get food here, then I think the synergy of having all these corporate and university types together, that happens. And you see it more on nice days when people are just out because it's so nice.
Right.
But until they get, you know, some places that we want to walk to eat,
right,
we don't really accomplish what we want to. You know, that same problem is in Research Triangle Park.
Right.
They built it with no commercial establishments and everybody had to drive home for lunch at first.
Right.
That's kind of the way it is here.
So you're beginning to touch on this, but I wanted to ask you, are there any sort of one that got away moments for you, not to put too fine a point on it, but are there any disappointments you associate with Centennial Campus?
In terms of corporate recruitment, you mean?
In terms of anything, but corporate recruitment.
Well, they're always. You don't get them all.
Sure.
And the bigger they are, the more people going after them, and the more incentives they're able to give. You know, we can't really give, today, for example, the rent market is so competitive. There are a lot of people out there not only giving half the rent that we would charge, but they're, you know, give you a free 6 months to move in. We're not in a position to do that. So some ways we can't compete for those big ones. You're always disappointed when you lose one. But see, what happens is you get all the partnership stuff going. And everybody's all excited about it. And the next guy you see is the CFO.
Right.
And he doesn't care about partnership.
Right.
He cares about comparing the spreadsheet that has all the rents on it. So unless you can compute the value of the partnership, then you better have a heck of a sell.
Right.
Well, how do you compute the value of partnership? The value of something that we might invent together someday. How do you put a value on it? So it depends on how hard a guy that is, that CFO, but you know, we have lost prospects over a $2 rent difference.
Really?
You know, $2 a square foot rent difference. Usually not less than that, though. I mean, they'll go for a little bit, but not so much. So, there are those moments. I think that there are other disappointments. You know, things you wish you'd thought of early on. Today everybody wishes they'd done more about the energy efficiency of buildings before we hit this crisis. But, you know, you deal with the things that are on fire right in front of you at the time. So,
absolutely.
I think the food thing is something that we did not. Our assumptions that we would get all these big tenants that would then have all these people that would eat lunch, right away.
Right.
That didn't work. See, you know, there's no dinner traffic here, and there's no weekend traffic here.
Right.
So, and there's no liquor licenses on state property. So, for a company to make money in a restaurant business, they got to make it on lunch and breaks.
Right.
And you got to really have a lot of traffic to make that work, and that's kind of what they're seeing. So, that wasn't very well thought out from the beginning, but you know, you don't know everything at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and there weren't a lot of people to learn from at the beginning.
In a general way, where do you see Centennial Campus being in its development? Where, for example,
About a quarter done.
Really?
In terms of actual building space, I think they're about a quarter done. David Winwood could answer that for you, but a lot more than a quarter of the infrastructure is in. You know, there are more sites than buildings. And when you include the veterinary school, the biomedical research campus over there, you know, of course they have a lot more land as well. And then there's parts of the Dorothea Dix campus that are now part of this that we haven't even begun to build on yet. So this will be, you know, we'll have a whole new university
right.
when this is over with. I see more of the university moving here as mm-hmm. they outgrow facilities and on the main campus. I don't see us ever deserting the main campus. But I think the connections, you know, this used to be considered way out there.
Right.
You know, they used to call it out to Centennial Campus, as right. though you had to pack a bag to right. come over here. If you're going to Centennial Campus during the day, we probably wouldn't be back to the main campus that day, you know. And it's, you know, it's no further than going out for lunch, but
right.
it's, you know, it was considered way out there. The textiles people fought tooth and nail.
Right.
They did not want to come over here. And now they would not go back to the main campus for anything. And engineering is finding the same thing in education. So I think what we're seeing is that the people who bring in a lot of research funding, the top research faculty in any college, don't have enough space on the main
right.
campus. And so this is becoming mm. the place where the top people have their labs, and
right.
the most modern labs, of course. So even if they also teach on the main campus, you know, they're in both places. So I think the future for Centennial Campus is really bright. There is always going to be this problem of having competitive rents.
Mm-hmm.
And it does cost universities more to put up buildings than it does private developers, and partly because we know the university is still going to be here in a couple hundred years. And
right.
so we want the buildings to last. But I think this, you know, they're going to put a library over here. There's going to be a town center,
right, right.
conference center. I think that this will take on, and the chancellor's home will move over here. I think this will take on the more the hub of the campus than
right.
the main campus, you know, years from now.
Hmm. And in general, were there any other topics you wanted to hit on, or anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I think that, you know, there were a lot of heroes in the, particularly in the beginning years.
Right.
A lot of people who already had full-time jobs,
mm-hmm.
who went through the public hearing process, which was, as Claude McKinney used to say, democracy at its most excruciating. They would never go through that process again. You know,
right.
1,000 acres inside the Beltline of the town, I mean, everybody had their eyes on this,
right.
and it was kind of a miracle that we were allowed to have this for the university. You know, I mentioned George taking a new attitude about the revenue stream. Charles Moreland,
mm-hmm.
who could have been strictly focused inward on academic research,
right.
and many, many universities are afraid you get too close to industry, they somehow pollute your thinking.
Right.
You know, he was a very forward-thinking guy, and he pushed hard all the time, fought the fight every day. And without, and then Claude McKinney,
mm-hmm.
I don't think ever had a day of doubt in his mind that this was going to be a great place, and so he pushed for it constantly. And I think without that combination, you know, of course there were architects and planners and the governor and chancellors, but without those three people during those years, at least that I was there, you know, and it was a tough balance,
right.
you know, a very tough balance between finance and design and
sure.
partnership, but I think without those three, this just wouldn't have happened. And you know, other people have tried to carry the model, and they can only carry pieces of it, and partly because they don't have the champions internally.
That's
so
terrific.
That's my tribute to them.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Sure thing.
Excellent.
Sure thing. Thank you.